from the twisted realm of science and the darkest pits of reason comes chilling tales of godlessness. Bear witness to the unfathomable terror that is the Good Atheist.
Welcome to the GoodAtheist.net podcast. My name is Jacob Forte.
And I am Ryan Harkness.
Today on the episode, I'd like to start off by saying that if you noticed that there was an absence of shows last week, two reasons for that. Number one, it was my dad's 60th birthday, so I took the week off and went to go spend time with him. And second, although we did record a show before I left, I did not want to put it up because it did not meet my standards of quality.
So. It was garbage.
It was garbage show, but we admitted that at the beginning of that lost episode, saying, well, I haven't really prepared for the show because it's been pretty hectic with family stuff, so this show's going to suck. And upon listening to it, it did suck. So
how does that work? It's like the amount of effort and time that you put into something directly correlates to the quality. Isn't that crazy?
It's so stupid. I hate it.
How about that?
I miss the old days where we could just pull incorrect information out of my brain, and then I could just go on that, incorrectly assuming I was correct. But, I mean, that was good at the time. I mean, I lived in a bubble of delusion, so it was fine back then. But now you can't. The internet is too cruel. They're too aware of me out there.
Jake's tired of being wrong.
I'm so tired of
being
wrong.
He spends all this time trying to be right, all stressed out about the fact that he's not getting stuff right anymore.
I know. Well, I never did before, but I suppose that's why people like listening to the old episodes. If you ever want to really listen to a dumbass, listen to the first few shows that I give. Quite entertaining. Today on the show, we're going to be talking about a book that Ryan's been reading about Sarah Palin, called The Rogue, or Going Rogue, or what is it?
The Rogue.
The Rogue.
It's that Joe McGinnis book. I'm sure you've heard about it because he was the guy that moved in next door to her. That created a big stir and
lots of publicity.
Yeah, the book just came out. I think it was last week or a week and a half ago. So,
and if you're one of those rare people that still reads Doonesbury, then there was some reference to that in his comic as well. Because one of his characters moves next door to Sarah Palin in the storyline, I believe.
What, in the Doonesbury comic?
That's correct, yeah.
Man.
So, anyways,
Saturday,
if you pay attention,
you know, all the comics and newspapers are pretty much garbage nowadays. Even Doonesbury. I'm like, it's just a...
Doonesbury's a happenstance. It's just that, from what I remember, he wasn't even trying to get a cartoon into syndication. It's just that they needed to fill a cartoon hole. He was there, and apparently they never get rid of bad shit.
This is the problem with the comics page, is that it's just there, and there's no culling. There's a whole bunch of stuff that's from forever ago. It's no longer funny. Even the people that retire, they just start recycling old comic strips. It's unbelievable. No way for any new blood to get in there. There's no quality.
It's just
control.
Dead anyway. It's just let
garbage.
It die, man.
It's just another piece of the newspaper that is completely useless in the 21st century, where your funny comes from the internet, and the internet is so much funnier.
Well, it's bigger. I don't know if it's funnier in general.
It is, well, not funnier in general.
I say if I took, you know, 10 random web comics and measured them against the comics and newspapers, they'd be equally terrible.
Okay, fair. But the best web comics are better than the best newspaper comics.
I definitely agree. We'll also be talking about an NPR interview with a man by the name of C. Peter Wagner. I'm going to be talking about him, his insane beliefs, and sort of like what that means, because it's another version of dominionism. I did a show before on that, unfortunately mispronouncing it. I pronounced it during the show Dominism, unfortunately. Mm. So, you know me and mispronunciation. An entire show where I do that. That's painful.
Again, we kind of live in the Great White North where religiosity isn't that big of a deal. We never hear anybody saying any of these words out loud, so it's kind of a problem.
A little bit.
It's like I have a whole bunch of medieval words from fantasy novels that I have no idea how to pronounce, just because I remember, paladins?
Yeah, I used to call them paladins.
Yeah, exactly. So it just happens. It's up there. It's up there with my hyperbole/hyperbole.
Oh yeah, I love the hyperbole.
Man, I was telling smart people for years that they were spewing hyperbole.
And finally, we're going to be talking about a scientific study about what makes people better learners. So that's going to be a little bit of we're doing the science headlines again because I just love these. And I've been cleaning up my Google Reader. And the first thing I noticed, and this is a kind of call out to people who listen to the show, is I've been trying to update my reader with all the best of the atheist blogs that are out there. Now, I'm already familiar with the bigger ones, but I wanted to ask people out there, have you heard of some of the smaller ones maybe that most people are not aware of? Because I really just want to know what everyone is doing in the scene, and that's not only the big wigs, you know? I just want to see who's up and coming, but it's not always obvious finding that. And trust me, most of the time, the saddest thing I realized, too, when I was doing a search myself to try to, you know, reignite my atheist blogosphere, which had started to, you know, a couple of them had just were gone, you know, like no longer updating. So I'm like, hey, it's time to get something new. Realizing that the lists of blogs, the blog rolls are from 2009 that appear when you start doing search for them. Many of these blogs are no longer around, and I'm sure there's been a few new ones, maybe exciting new prospects that have come up since then. So we haven't exactly done a good job as a scene to let people know where the good stuff is, and I figure that's one of the holes that a good atheist wants to plug, people.
Don't just blame us as a scene. I would also blame search engine content and stuff like that.
But the search engine content is reliant on the posts that people make that are within our scene and people that have enough traffic in order for them to appear. That's just how all search engine works.
Yeah, I know, but you'd figure that the search engine would weigh the fact that this information is from 2007. I mean, that's light years in internet time. It's ridiculous.
Well, yes and no. I mean, I think for most...
The internet is a living organism, and it's been around for, like, what? For so many years now, and Google's been crawling so much information, it's really got to start weighing the newest information much heavier.
But then what the fuck would appear? Where are the big fucking articles from 2010, 2011, talking about the big blog roll?
It's not my problem. Google, fix it.
Oh, yeah, okay. Google, who I pay you nothing, fix it.
Oh, yeah, Google doesn't make money off the fact that we use their stuff.
I'm just saying that you personally are not fucking paying it money.
Whatever.
And you always want more.
I do.
Look, I'm saying I don't want to wait for Google in order to be able to have some fucking decent atheist shit.
That's fair. I wasn't saying that you're not allowed to ask. I'm just saying that don't just blame the atheist community. You got to blame the tools that we have to search the internet.
No, you don't blame tools, things that you can't change. Do you blame your hammer because it's not hammering the right way you'd like, fool?
I'd blame my hammer if it wasn't a saw.
No, I'm sorry, that is not an accurate comparison. The Google is not a saw when you're trying to fucking hammer something, like a search.
If I went to the hardware store and asked for something that would saw something, and they gave me a hammer, I'd be like, you, sir, need to...
Get off your analogy, it doesn't even make any sense. You're dying on a stupid hill, man.
I tried to save it. It almost worked.
All right, well, before we begin, though, I want to talk about my father's 60th birthday, because there's a couple things about that that, you know, I was thinking about and I wanted to share on the show, because there must be people who are listening that are either turning close to 60 or already 60, or, you know, just maybe a few years from now. What can you expect? And truth be told, before I went to go see my dad, I hadn't seen him in a number of months because I'd been traveling. And I was worried at first because he was talking about needing a cane and that kind of stuff, and then he couldn't work at his job in landscaping anymore, which is a big deal, you know? And I was expecting, okay, it's his 60th birthday, and you know how people are with numbers, right? 6-0, he's going to feel old, he's going to feel, you know, sort of like as though his life is over, maybe.
So having freakouts every 30 years is a Forte special?
Well, that's just what I thought, especially given the type of man my father was. I mean, he worked for himself in landscaping. He, you know, essentially, it's not really a business that he ran. It was more like an artist, except for his art was, you know, how shaving trees or making nice decors for people outside their lawns and shit like that, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, in that sense, a lot of his identity, if you want, was tied up with his job. So you wonder, how does a person who previously identified themselves through their work, and I would say that's a lot of people out there that are listening right now would identify themselves through their work, all right? It doesn't matter if you're a fucking doctor or if you work at an advertising agency or for Walt Disney or whatever. If you have a conversation with someone, obviously what is one of the first things that's going to pop up? What do you do, right? It's part of the way you identify yourself.
Yeah.
I was really glad, though, when I saw him, when we came down. Here's a couple things that I didn't realize. Number one, how good he would be in terms of mood from all of his kids coming down to see him Because it's, you know, when you have a divorced family and you're a lot of kids and they have their own families and husbands and stuff like that, it's really difficult for everybody to be at the same place at the same fucking time.
Yeah.
But the big 6-0, man, it was like the ring of Sauron, man, the ring of power, bringing people to him.
Well, 6-0 is when you're 100% past the 50% point in your life. It's, you know, people hit 50, they could hit 100. But when you hit 60, what are the chances you're going to hit 120? You're definitely...
You don't want to hit 120,
You are up past that upward slope. You are more than halfway done your journey, my friend.
You're on the slow hill that eventually leads to nothingness.
I was going to say that you've done the uphill climb and now it's downhill, but...
But it's still kind of a slow hill. Look, 60 is not... You're not all of a sudden on Widow's Peak... Fucking going down this mad ass.
I do still feel bad for this generation hitting 60. I feel like the next few generations that hit 60, they're gonna have a lot more fun because we're gonna be able to just live on.
We
the
will
internet.
Be immortal. Our still stem cell toothpaste,
Jacob,
which will restore everything.
We'll be living in the computer, flying on the nets.
Right, flying on the nets. So he was happy about that, but I think the most important thing was that I finally saw my father being able to transition away from his old life into his new hobby, which is photography, for instance. And he's really trying to take a serious go at it. He sold a number of photos, and he is quite good at it. But I found, I guess it was reassuring to see that even a man as, I would say, stubborn as my father could transition and seem to do it so well. Like, he was extremely happy. He was better. He looked younger, in fact, than he had, for a number of years. He looked far healthier.
Well, I imagine not doing all that landscaping when he has how many cracked vertebrae?
Well, I believe they removed one of his discs, or fused two of his discs. They removed that spongy little area in between your vertebrae. So, yes, that was gone. So, Not great for manual labor, but I think it's also something along the lines of when you get to that age. I mean, like, he was seeing the end of his career in something, but in photography he sees the beginning of something else. And I think this is really important for people who kind of transition to that stage in their lives, because one of the best ways for a person to live a long life is to feel useful. You know, to have goals, aspirations, new fucking projects. I mean, this whole idea of retirement, I just don't see it. You know, I think it was a bad idea to begin with. I think it's just an invitation to decrepitude. I would say, rather, you should have, in your twilight years, projects that you can really fall in love with. I mean, you have the time now, presumably most of you, but you got to make something of yourself even as you age. And I think that in this time, a lot of people, I would suggest, take up a hobby that's scientific. Build your own fucking telescope. There's all kinds of interesting little... You could be a gentlemanly scientist, like in the old days, you know what I mean? When you're doing experiments from home and shit like that. Except for in our cases, we can do things that are much simpler. We could do market research, or we could do just studies. These are things that people can do in their spare time. Fucking hobbies, man, they exist out there, and they can be, they can improve our world. They don't necessarily only have to be, I don't know, planting flowers or something quaint. Like, fucking go for broke, baby. I think the bigger the project, the more love you're going to have into it. Maybe it won't have an end to it, but maybe that's the point. Maybe the project should never have a foreseeable end. It should always continue, because hopefully you will for as long as possible.
I know what I'm going to be doing when I'm 60.
What's that?
Walmart greeter.
I don't think you're good at greeting. You're not a very social person.
I didn't say I'd do it well.
Well, it's a greeter. I mean, why don't you just, I don't know, stock
Look,
greeter, shelves
greeters are actually really just there to make sure you're not stealing stuff. They aren't really there to greet you. They're there to greet you with mistrust.
Really?
That's the point of Walmart greeters.
That's sad.
Mm-hmm. It's to make sure people aren't running out with shoplifting stuff. They basically put the old people on the front lines.
They could easily be pushed down. I don't understand why you'd want these soldiers.
Some guy actually just went to jail because he did push over an old dude while stealing a television from Walmart. And the old dude had like a brain aneurysm and died.
So that's how they do it. They set up the most vulnerable as kind of like a shield. It's like having babies in front, and if you knock one over and you kill it, you're totally going to jail for a long time, man. It's brilliant.
I like it.
Another blow for Walmart. You certainly know
how
to exploit
this? Okay.
old people.
You get a catapult, and you put a baby in it, like a newborn. Yeah. It can be like an incubator thing with an open top. And then if anybody walks through the turnstile with like something that hasn't been like demagnetized security-wise, and the alarm goes off, the baby gets flung into like the forest.
But what if the magnet didn't really demagnetize properly? Then you could have legally purchased it, and you just killed a baby.
Well, then it would be the cashier's fault.
Yeah, no, I see. I don't like that. If you're going to put the baby, maybe you put a baby that fewer people care about, like crack babies.
I like it.
Yeah. You can feel bad, but then you're like, well, it was probably better that way.
He was addicted to crack. You feel bad, but not that bad.
Yeah, there you go.
You get your cake and you eat it too.
Correction for last show. We had incorrectly guessed that a shekel, an ancient unit of monetary measurement used by the Jews, was worth a dollar.
Don't let me in on this.
It had been a reference to the fact that if in the Old Testament, this is the last bonus show, Bible Stories, where we talked about the laws of the Old Testament, and one of the laws in particular is that if you have sex with a virgin who is not promised to some other guy, you have to marry her and you have to pay the father 50 shekels, which we incorrectly assume was $50. It is, in fact, with today's inflation, $37. So important to note that there is a correction there, not $50. It is indeed $37 you will have to pay the father.
Well, that's like today's shekel value versus, like,
right.
I don't know, like, because back in the day, one shekel was probably, like, I don't, you
no, no, it was,
it,
this, this is what this I'm is, talking about. When you're measuring inflation, you're also measuring the particular value of the currency in regards to the populace. $37 of the time. That's what it is. So, it's good to know. It's good to know.
Okay.
Let's talk about this book that you're reading, because first of all, I try to read a couple segments off of it. There's a link. The New York Times has an article where they show a couple pages of it. I got to tell you, though, I phased out at first because it sounds like a whole bunch of gossipy shit.
Well, look at it like this. I mean, I think I mentioned this on one of the past shows. Maybe it was one of the ones that didn't go up. I don't know.
It was.
That I basically stopped reading about American politics because it's too depressing. Yet, here I am reading this book about Sarah Palin. What's the deal? Well, I just decided I would stop inundating myself with just little snippets off the internet about random stuff. If you want to learn about a topic, a nice long article in a magazine, in a quality magazine like, I don't know, Time or American Scientist or something like that, usually better than just these hodgepodge opinion pieces that are coming out all the time. I thought I knew about Sarah Palin. I used to read the Daily
Telegraph?
No. I used to read, what was it called?
Daily Mail?
Shut up. I used to read.
You don't even know what you're reading.
The Daily Dish, Andrew Sullivan's blog, and he was obsessed with Sarah Palin, so I thought I had a pretty good idea what she was all about. But one of the big things that I misunderstood about her was I used to think that her religionist streak or Christianism, her Christianity, how
her
she
religiosity,
put, her religiosity was a sham, because everything about her was fake, and I figured that she was just
a hypocrite piece of shit
who was just using that religion thing to
further her claim.
Yeah, exactly. Like many politicians, we've talked about this before. What was the name of that group that basically believes that all the higher power people basically just don't believe in God, but they use the whole God thing because.
I think you're referring to, was it Milton Friedman who said that it was the noble lie,
mm-hmm.
where you would tell, believers that you were a believer yourself because you're like, well, it makes them better people and happier, even though this thing is, we know it to be false. So.
Yeah. I always kind of thought that she was just one of those because everything else was insincere. So I thought the religiosity thing was too, but no, she is a straight up crazy hardcore religionist, and it really makes you realize how scared you should be of her.
I'm actually more scared of Sarah Palin than Rick Perry the more I learn about Rick Perry, especially considering the fact that I view Rick Perry more as an opportunist than as a particularly religious person. In fact, we'll be talking about that a bit later with some of the you know, crazier versions of Christianity, the real believers and their attitude towards Rick Perry, which it seems to be eroding, unfortunately, as they're realizing that the man is just clearly more after money than he is whatever values or agendas that they would have.
But I feel like we give some of these people, you know,
a slide?
Not so much a slide, but just maybe not enough credit, because we always figure that their faith is bullshit, or it's just you know, it's just to just they're using it for political advantage. But with Sarah Palin, I mean, she's been a crazy religious bigot since she was a child, always involved in the church. Her mom, according to this book, was so wrapped up in the church that she basically didn't raise the children.
So, what? It's constantly in church?
And in turn, that basically rubs off on Sarah Palin, because it's said in the book, once again, that she just isn't a very good mom at all, because she's just always doing stuff to further her political goals and doesn't take care of raising the kids or taking care of anything. I agree with you that the book has this very gossipy side to it, because everything in it is based off of conversations with residents of Wasilla, which is where she basically was born and raised and became the mayor of, which kind of started her political career. But there's a lot of stuff in there that is, you know, undoubtedly true. It's on the record. This is what happened. And this is the scary stuff. The fact that Sarah Palin got into politics specifically so that she could stop the local hospital from giving abortions. That was her first political action, and if it wasn't for her successful campaign to try, well, semi-successful, we'll get into that in a few seconds, to stop the hospital from giving abortion, she would have never gotten into the rest of politics whatsoever. So that goes to show you the fundamentalism that lies at the core of Sarah Palin. And it was a classic, you know how we have all these school board issues right now, where basically religious people are forcing their way onto school boards?
Well, the school boards don't really have requirements in terms of who's allowed to be on one. So it's a really good opportunity for religious zealots to essentially get on and try to undermine the education in children, really.
Well, this is what happened with this hospital. Basically, the way it worked is there was one hospital in the Wasilla area that gave abortions, and They have a council that basically kind of runs things. And if you're a member, quote unquote, of the hospital, which costs $5 registration fee to become a member of,
sounds very hard.
Yeah, you can vote to put whoever you want onto the council. So Sarah and all of her nutty church friends became members of the hospital so that they could vote out all of the pro-abortion people on the board.
Wow.
And then said, no more abortions. Fortunately, the Supreme Court knocked her back, and so there are still abortions at this hospital, but this is step one. From there, she got into the city council, not because... This is where you find out how small Wasilla is, because this is another thing that you don't realize, how shitty Alaska is and how crappy it is out there. Wasilla was all basically wife beaters and drug users. And they didn't even have a police force, and they needed a police force, but you need to bring in revenue to do that. So they brought Sarah Palin onto the city council because she had the connections with the crazy religious gun nuts. So they brought her in to convince people to pay a sales tax, to get a police force, to stop...
Sales tax? That sounds like socialism.
That sounds like big government. No, seriously, that's what it was. It was, they needed one of those... They needed one of those crazy right-wing people to come in.
It is not... It doesn't sound like a 21st century kind of place.
Well, I mean, this was... God, I think it was like 89 or 91 or something. Like, this was a...
The Old West!
This was a primitive time in Alaska's history, let me tell you what. As soon as she got into the council, though, she started getting more politically active, became the mayor. Once she became the mayor, she immediately fired a ton of people and replaced them with evangelicals. Straight-up dominionism, man. Just
Dominism. No, I don't even know anymore. Okay, here's my question. Did she do any good? Was there anything that she did that you could say improvement over the old?
Here's the problem. I'm about halfway through the book, so we've just, or maybe like two-fifths. I'm just at the point where she's become the mayor and she's just replacing everybody that disagrees with her with her religious wingnut friends. Like the librarian, the town librarian, is getting fired right now because Sarah Palin wants books about gay people out of the library. And when the librarian's like, no, that's censorship, so no, she gets fired.
You're fucking fired.
She already fired the museum person because she wants to basically shut down the museum because it's sciencey and it detracts from the word of God. Crazy
Damn.
Religious wingnut stuff. Reading what you end up reading about Sarah Palin just in the regular national news and everything else, and even if you dig a little bit deeper, you find out that she's obviously always pandering to that base, but you don't realize how hardcore she is into it. Imagine what she would have done as vice president or, heaven forbid, president. Like, the day John McCain dies, over the next... What was it? I guess it's the next year.
No, well, that's not fair, because he would have had a lot more pressure. You know, when you're a U.S. senator, they show up how many days of the year? Like half the fucking days of the year, if that?
Yeah.
Fucking can't. He ruins my shows. He ruins my shows. I'll miss him when he's dead.
So that's basically where I've gotten up to. I'll report back to you guys on the more crazy religious fundamentalist stuff that she does. But I think you're
grokking her.
I underestimated her and her religiosity, and a certain degree, I took it not for granted, but I just took it as a ruse, and I didn't give it the respect that it deserved. And it really scares you to realize that there are people out there who think like this, especially. Evil people. I mean, she's firing people and blackballing them from basically being able to get jobs in this area. She's ruining people's lives, and she's doing it left and right with glee.
Man, I feel like we have a false image of what our world is really like. You know, when we think we live in the 21st century. Okay, well, you and I do, and I'd say a couple hundred million people do. But lots of, you know, billions of people live in the 16th century, in the 13th century, in the 11th century. We're not all caught up here. We even have, there's even human tribes that are not out of the Stone Age, okay? That are alive today in some forests in Brazil. They live the same way that we've lived for 100 fucking thousand years. Has not changed. So this idea that we're all caught up, that we live in the 21st century, is a fucking joke, man. I tell you what, you know in Star Trek, whenever they say, oh yeah, this is the world of the 24th century, do you have a couple places maybe that aren't quite at the 24th century? You know, just you, even on your own planet, maybe they're still at the 21st century, still kind of greedy as shit, still fighting each other over resources and what have you.
Yeah, and to a large degree, it's no longer just a question of place, but also of time and custom. There's a lot of people that want to go back to the way it was back in the good old days.
I remember there's an article. It's actually an interview on Sam Harris's blog. It's in the notes with Steven Pinker, who has a new book. And his new book is essentially about the fact that as a society, as a planet, we're becoming less violent. And of course, when you say that, there's obviously going to be a few people who say, "Well, look." You know, did the Nazis, wasn't this World War II, wasn't this an example of brutality because of the sheer numbers of people? But he says, well, you can't look at numbers. You have to look at those numbers in terms of the proportion of the population. And even the First World War doesn't even make it to the top 100 mass killings of mankind's history when you look at the proportions. So we don't have a good idea of what violence is. But one of the arguments that he says for when he's like, because I think Sam Harris just tries to play the devil's advocate and say, well, wasn't there modernity in Germany at the time? Or wasn't there a lot of, liberals and so on and so forth? And what he's trying to argue is saying, well, that was one aspect of society. That's one element of it. But it's not the only element. And one element, say the fascist, cruel, crazy side, killed all those motherfuckers. So they were gone, all right? That cultural little group was eliminated. And once you realize that there isn't ever one dominant cultural force that will dominate forever, it's just made up of many different forces all vying for fucking power. Which brings me up to our next part of the show, which was an NPR article with a guy by the name of C. Peter Wagner. We'll just call him Peter, because obviously he doesn't like his first name. But this guy is one of the leaders of something called the New Apostolic Reformation. God, you gotta love the way that religious people always come up with names for shit, eh? They have plans, man. They have fucking plans. And these guys' plans fall pretty much in the line of that whole dominionism, where they want to take control of the government, of art and culture and education, every aspect, because they want to see their power as, apostles and things like that, restored. They want to be part of the decision-making process, and they believe that God is guiding that process. So, Jesus is actively trying to make sure that these kinds of people are getting into power. When really, it's not so much his effort, where it's mostly the effort of people living here on this planet who want to see that happen. I'm not seeing a lot of fucking invisible friend making people disappear or appear in certain positions or what have you. But I want you guys to go and listen to this NPR interview, because there's one thing that I got to say for it, and this is probably why I hate fucking NPR, is that, the whole time they're talking to this guy, who is quite crazy, as you'll soon see, the whole time they're talking to him, they're just throwing him softballs. They'll say, oh, it's an honor for you to be on the show, doctor. Oh, yeah, doctor of theology. I wish that we would stop giving doctorates or calling people doctors when their expertise is in nonsense. All right, I should be able to have a doctorate in Star Wars if I want to at this rate. Oh, well, I know how many angels can fit on the head of a pin. Give me a doctorate, people. I wouldn't call him a doctor if you fucking paid me to do it. So I want to review what this guy believes, because this is an important part of this new movement and what they're all about. So they're a group that has really taken a much more literal approach to their spirituality. So for instance, this guy believes that the Emperor of Japan, shortly after the Second World War when they signed a peace treaty, had officially announced that he was not a deity, he was not a god, which apparently, according to this guy, they were affiliated with spirits and demons. The sun goddess, which he was before spiritually bound to, they broke those bounds, and for seven glorious years, Christianity was allowed and started making some headway in Japan, until people started realizing it was stupid bullshit, in which he says the emperor again had sex with the sun goddess, and since that time that this demon has latched itself to Japan, they have been having disasters, one disaster after another.
So they turned away from the sun goddess after they got nuked.
Right.
And for a couple of years after that, Christianity was around. But then the emperor had sex with the sun goddess again. And since then, they've been living in sin with false prophets and gods.
Right. Well, the whole thing is based on a kind of Japanese ritual where the emperor is supposed to be a deity, and he is supposed to sort of, mate with the sun goddess. But all of that is just pretty much poetic fucking allegory. It would be difficult for you to find a modern Japanese person who thinks that shit's real. You know what I mean? Yeah, the sun goddess. Yeah, for sure, our emperor, he definitely put his wiener up in there. Definitely, that's why we have so many male heirs, which they don't have. Their thinning bloodline must be a result of that. But what he was trying to suggest was that the tsunami was directly a result of God removing his protection from Japan and allowing natural forces to essentially destroy a significant portion of their coast.
Well, hey, at the very least, he didn't say that God just did it. It was more like God didn't protect them. That's all God did. God was like, whatever. And it just
you're
happened.
Fucked now.
Yeah, exactly.
Which makes me kind of at first I was wondering, well, how does this guy view reality, right? Does he just view God as a big giant insurance policy?
Who protects the people that he likes and not the people that he doesn't?
Right. I guess they view it from this idea that, well, we're white and prosperous, and we haven't had a tsunami like you did. Although we kind of did with with Katrina and shit. But never mind that. That was probably homosexuality or something that they can blame. But really, honestly, as far as these types of people, these apostolic individuals who really think that they are modern day versions of the apostles like Paul and shit like that, they're like, we're bringing in new information about what's happening in this fight with the spirit world. They take, like I said before, a literal approach to this whole thing. Now, I couldn't find any books by this Mr. Wagner, but I did find something that his wife wrote, which was a book on exorcisms.
Oh boy.
And how to perform them and shit like that. And she has a list of, you know, she lists out a number of things that she thinks are the reason why society is infested with demons. Because this is another thing that he believes, him and his group believe, that people are not possessed by devils, but rather seduced by devils, and Satan works through these seduced people. So you and I would probably be an example of two seduced people that are working with Satan. We're not possessed, because they claim that that's not a good word, because it makes the person seem as though they're not in control. We're fully in control of ourselves. We're working with Satan, though. And Absolutely. They view that literally.
Absolutely. I mean, I get tempted into all sorts of awesome sin.
On an almost constant basis.
Absolutely.
And you know what?
My brain is completely held in the vice grip of Satan.
Well, you can't easily break free of that delicious vice grip. Now, there is one quote I want to read to you, because I think this is perfect. This is from her book. And I think it summarizes nicely with, you know, how these people sort of try to justify what they do. Because next show, the bonus show that we do next, I'm hopefully going to have more on exorcisms, because just delving into her book, you're starting to see like a treasure trove of bullshit. But I want to read you this line. It says, I am, when she's trying to explain that she's not really very knowledgeable in theology or pretty much anything, she says, I am more of a person of faith and obedience than quantitative knowledge. I figure if Jesus chose unlearned fishermen as his first students, it clearly demonstrates that vast theoretical knowledge may not be a prerequisite to the ministry of deliverance. So in other words, since Jesus chose illiterate morons to be his apostles, surely he loves illiterate morons.
Illiterate morons shall lead the earth.
That's correct. They shall inherit the earth, my friend. The more ignorant, the better. Remember, obedience is what's necessary here, and definitely this is what these guys want. But it's important, I think, for everyone to realize where the obedience lies. Because guys like Peter Wagner and his group, they want obedience to whatever the fuck they're saying. You know, these apostles of God, I'm talking to Jesus, you got to listen to what I say. I bet you would love if everyone agreed with you. I can see why you're trying to mold the world to fit that fucking vision. Trust me when I say, I want no part of it, sir. You are my enemy. You clearly, guys like this, these are our enemies. They want to change government to further their bullshit. And when you really read how literal they are about everything, it's actually kind of scary. When they say that people are possessed by demons, you can identify these people. I'd love to ask them, saying, if someone's possessed by a devil, what would you consider someone murders that person? Are they committing murder, or are they fighting Satan?
Is Obama possessed by the devil?
Well, he wasn't very clear about that.
Is he the Antichrist?
Well, I would be willing to say that behind closed doors, I'm sure he would say that. But he's still probably at a level of notoriety that saying that can be bad in terms of attraction, the wrong kind of attention. Because I don't think these guys really want... I think they mistakenly assume that they want a lot of attention. But that's not generally a good idea. The spotlight tends to be cruel on folks. And not everyone is as softball as fucking NPR, where they're just, I don't know, mysteriously without opinion. You know, it's like, oh, okay, I'm just going to ask you about this crazy bullshit, and I'm never going to call you on it ever. Congratulations. That's delightful journalism.
Oh, what is it? There's a specific expression to explain what it is, but it's kind of like where the author tries to weigh both views equally, and therefore it's the view from nowhere is what it's called. There we go.
Yeah.
Where they don't side with one or the other. They just kind of present both sides as if they were equal, as if it wasn't 99%. This is
complete crazy
this
bullshit.
Is complete crazy bullshit. 1%. Well, a person has a right to say and believe what they feel and blah blah blah.
Yeah. When somebody says that God essentially punished a nation through a global, you know, through a catastrophe, a natural catastrophe. I think it's time to probably call them on that shit. You know, at the very least, ask them a related question, saying, like, do you believe that all natural disasters are a way of God communicating with people? Do you really think that you have presented the best compelling case of how God is trying to communicate this? I mean, he could be communicating something else, like maybe your dick face We're all dick faces? Because, I mean, if I read the Bible, which is what everyone wants, I mean, when you read, again, his wife's book, and she's like, we need to go back to biblical teachings and blah, blah. I mean, when we did the bonus show on the laws of the Pentateuch, do we really want to teach those laws? Go back to biblical values? Are you fucking serious? Like, you remember the correction. $37 to pay a man if you raped his virgin daughter. Yeah. Let's go back to biblical values, shall we? Fan-fucking-tastic idea. I think we're going to move on anyways. I don't want to talk too much about this NPR interview. You guys should listen to it. Listen to the whole thing. This crazy man just going on and on about how he thinks every little bit of mythology is literally true. He's like, yep, Zeus and those kinds of things, they're really just the devil manifesting himself to other people to confuse them of the message of Christ and to really ultimately lead to the Battle of Armageddon, which is their big hard-on. This is what they're waiting for. The majority of people to be annihilated and the kingdom of Jesus to come back so that everyone can have, you know, the same belief that C. Peter Wagner has.
That's always been the weird thing about Abrahamic religions, especially Christianity, is it's essentially a death cult.
It is pretty much a death cult. It's a death cult, too, where, you know, in the old days, Christians didn't used to call themselves Christians because they were afraid of the labels. They knew very well that Baptists are different than Presbyterians and, you know, everybody had their little sect, and they didn't want any fucking business to do with anybody else because as far as they're concerned, a Seventh-day Adventist is as much of a fucking apostate as a Muslim, right? If it's not your exact bullshit, then everyone else is wrong. And trust me, when you have this whole attitude that eventually the world will be cleansed and believe precisely what you do, then you're right about one thing. The world would need to be cleansed pretty majorly for there to be only your fucking homogenous belief to exist. In fact, you know, I've always held the idea that most people, when pressed, would find that their own beliefs are not even the same as their church's beliefs, their neighbor's beliefs, maybe even their fucking spouse's beliefs. Everybody's got their own little fucking version of it, because guess what? It's really just a reflection of your ego. That's all it is. See, God will always agree with what you agree. What a fucking coincidence. All right, the last thing I want to talk about is a pretty cool headline that I was reading on Wired Blogs, and it was about a study that had found, like, that was basically went out to search for the answer to this question: why are some people better at learning than others? And one of the tests that they did, and this is probably, I think, the most intriguing part of the whole study, is that they got kids to do some fairly challenging puzzles, and all they did was they divided the group amongst people who would be giving compliments in a different way. The first compliment they gave to kids was praising them on their effort to try to solve these difficult puzzles. The second group was told that they were smart when they completed the puzzles. Now, how do you think that turned out? Just based on sort of like, just take a wild guess. How do you think that turned out?
Well, maybe the kids that got praised while they were working on it did it slower.
Well, you're not too far off. It turns out that the people who were praised for their intelligence, they would actually perform worse on subsequent exams, challenge themselves a lot less, and feel more frustrated from their failures. And those that were praised for their efforts had the exact opposite reaction. And I get the conclusion that they made, and obviously in any study,
you can
debate the conclusions, but I agree with the conclusions here. The idea here is that when you praise a person for their intelligence, what they do is they become much more defensive and fear losing that status, right? They don't want to appear stupid, and so they'll try to do things that make them appear intelligent, while those that were praised for their effort were more concerned with trying to learn, and were there more likely to fail. Like in terms of the effort put in by people, or not effort, but just how much failure they accepted before they gave up, those that were praised for their efforts were much more likely to fail. And some of the things that they have found out, because they were measuring also what was happening in the brain, what parts of the brain were being stimulated. And they just found that it wasn't how you framed the compliment had a massive impact on sort of a person's reaction to it. And I think what that means is not to say, okay, now praising a person is going to solve that problem. I think what it demonstrates only is that, number one, if you're going to learn, there you need two things. Number one is you cannot be afraid to fail. So you need at least some degree of humility. You need to accept that when you're trying to do something, even for the first time, you will be terrible at it. Everything you will do will be major suckitude. But, you know, double your rate of failure if you want to achieve success. So again, I mean, this is one of those things that I've said on lots of shows. More proof here that we're having that if you want to succeed at something, you have to constantly fail. So yeah. It's encouragement for anybody out there that's doing anything, being like, why am I sucking at this? Well, sucking is part of being good at something. It's, in fact, the most important part. And the most important thing for you is not to feel great at something. It's for you to feel as though the effort is worth it. And the rest follows. So I think that's an important lesson learned from a very interesting study. Again, like I said, you can make your own conclusions about it. There'll be links for it in the notes. But I thought, man, this is a pretty interesting analysis of how we look at our successes, our failures, and ultimately how that affects the way we view ourselves. Like, people who fail a lot might feel like they're, you know, failures, even though they're the ones who are taking more effort to get good. It's a bit of a strange irony there. Maybe that explains why so many people have a difficult time actually trying to do something. You know what I mean? Like trying to succeed at something because of that fear of failure that we have. And maybe part of it is the way that we coddle people when we tell kids, oh, you know, you're smart when they do something. And you're like, oh, I made him feel good. Well, no, you increase the pressure that he feels now to keep that your perception of his intelligence. So you can't really, you don't want to fuck somebody up from just giving them the wrong incentive.
Yeah, I've heard some of that before. When they're talking about how they want to overhaul the school systems and stuff, they often say, well, the way that it's currently set up now with quizzes and tests and stuff, it basically punishes kids for, you know, basically taking the test and failing it, and that was your one shot at it, and that's it. It's ridiculous.
And it doesn't reflect the effort put into it.
It doesn't reflect anything as far as how a person should learn, as far as trying something, not being able to get past it, trying it again, and then finally getting it and succeeding. That's how things work in life, but in school, if you hit that hurdle and you're not sprinting, you're going to just fall on your face, and that's the end. That's once you go through one of those hurdles, everybody else is ahead of you, and you're on your face.
Oh, man. This is why I've always said, too, that the end of school is not the end of learning, okay? And for most people out there, sometimes it's the beginning of it. If you've got to go through the school system for whatever reason, be it for you to be a professional or at least get a decent job, I understand. It's now become a test of society. But for a lot of people out there, they may find that when they come out of it, they'll be a lot less knowledgeable than they thought they'd be. But you're not supposed to rely on them anymore if you really want to learn. I mean, think about this. When I was in school, they were giving classes on Windows 3.1. Not exactly the most useful fucking class in the world. Things moved a little bit faster than the speed of a course, fortunately.
Well, it's kind of going back to what you were saying before about your dad and getting old and retirement and everything else. I think there was like a philosopher that basically said that stable societies need stable people, but fast-moving societies need fast-moving people or fast-changing people. So you have to be ready to adapt. A lot of the stuff that you're going to be learning earlier on isn't actually going to be all that useful when you're out and about in the field. It is basically just a test.
Well,
a litmus test to see if you're willing to waste this much time and money and effort to get this piece of paper that says you're not a flake.
Well, I'm happy that we have a lot of listeners that are older and that have been at least giving the whole internet thing a try. Because I really feel that people, you know, the older generations that have decided, I don't want any interactivity with this new world, are really fucking selling themselves short on this. I mean, even my dad, when he was in his 50s, before anybody gave him a computer or the internet, he was totally saying, oh, I'm never going to use that. It's not for me. He had a fairly closed mind to it. But once he really saw the advantage of being connected, the advantage of spending the fucking time needed to learn it, yeah, which involves fucking failure. You know, I don't think a lot of old people out there that are not learning that it has anything to do with the fact that they don't have the wits to do it. It's just that maybe they're afraid of failure or they hate that feeling and they just want to do the same old, same old. But like I said before, I think that's a good way to go to the grave fucking nice and early. You know, take the easy route. Don't learn anything new. Don't feel fucking useful and then wonder why everyone around you is gone. No good, man. Just because you're old doesn't mean you stop living. In fact, it's just a different kind of life in today's society, man. And that's just how it is. seeing my dad at his 60s makes me a lot less afraid of my 60s. I don't know what it's going to be like, but I'm like, if my dad can adapt to it, which I never thought he'd be able to do at this level, then fuck, so can I. And so can you! Okay, well, I think that ties it up for the show. I'd like to thank everybody who's a contributing member. Remember, if you love the show, $20 a year gets you access to all of our backlog, and we've got like just so many shows now, almost 100 bonus shows. That would tide you over for a long time, unless you're a crazy crack addict for it, in which case, I'm like, I can't help you. We can only provide so much content. You're probably going to need to see somebody about that. All right, with that, my name is Jacob Forte.
And I'm Ryan Harkness.
Have a good Atheist Day, everybody.